good old pal to me. Take me everywhere I want to go, get my transportation free.
This is Dave Monk, your Prairie Monk. WEFT Champaign 90.1 on your FM dial.
And Dave on the board. This is February. Let's see, where are we? February the 9th, 2020. And you're tuned to WEFT. This is the Prairie Monk program. WEFT's weekly look at rails, trails, greenways. Ugh, freezing rain. Not a good day to go bicycling. Might be a good day to just stay in the house and hope that lines don't start freezing and bad whatever. But let's be cheerful.
Rice snow out there.
Yes.
It's icy. I wanted to say something about Mary Ellen Schrontz. She passed recently. And she was one of those people who were curriculum development people. They had an office on Lincoln Avenue where there was a school. There's no longer a school there. It's apartment buildings. But she and other people put together units to help teachers teach. And I'm very interested in that because it bridges between information that's not totally understood and gives teachers a chance to be aware of what they're doing and still be in control. The unit you give them doesn't overwhelm them, and they're still the experts and the people who know the children around. She had a daughter that was, I think I remember, was married to someone who was doing research on milkweed that had an allergy to it. So you have to remember these little pieces of information that you have that relate to people who are dear to us all. The Camera Club has an excellent exhibit. They always have an excellent exhibit. It's between 9 and 17. It was up yesterday. And they have an excellent list of the people who are involved. It involves a multiple county area and covers topics that range from animals to architecture to black and white, which is an unusual photographic thing at the moment. And there are club members and landscapes and nature and general and people and youths, and some of the youths were as young as 4. And I encourage you to go to Lincoln Square and check that out. It'll be up for a couple of weeks there. And the Camera Club has been in action since 1935, and it meets regularly during the school year and communicates a lot with Bloomington, another photographic club there, and I go occasionally, and that's very good. I want to say something about PACA. PACA usually has a combined annual meeting and awards meeting, and they've decided this year to separate those two because sometimes the people who come to get awards are different from the people who are controlling the organization. And so it means that the two have to go through each other's information. So the attempt is to put the awards on Griggs in a banner. It will be at an Anvil and Forge Brewing Company. And it'll be 6 p.m. On the 22nd of February, And I encourage you to go to that because it's just supportive of a lot of the work that Packer does to salvage buildings and to give people information. There's a nice flyer with an article by Brian Adams, who is interested in Royal buildings, and he's done a nice job on an article about the building that was, he was, it was a Freeman building, and Freeman was married to a Busey, and Busey's had some involvement in this, and it's a house that's on and still exists on Elm Street. The annual meeting will come later in April, April 25th, and it probably will be at the Inman Hotel. So I was encouraged to say something about bees and pollinators, and we've done some of this before, but the National Wildlife Action Fund has decided to ask people to promote roadside for wildlife. It's for bees, but also for butterflies and birds like hummingbirds and creatures that need energy to move on to a next place. So they would encourage you to look at sites that could be developed as roadsides for wildlife. We have long since been working with the corridor between Paxton and Rantoul, and we have a 9-acre site at the Rantoul end, and we would hope that that corridor could be prairie preservation site, but it also has an old Route 45 on it, and we would hope that that could be a hike and bike trail. So, but in behind here, we ask you to write a letter to your member or to Stephanie Dobbs, who's with the Department of Transportation that owns most of the area. It's wide because it has a main line, and then it has a retired interurban and a retired old Route 45 and a widening road where they were going to have a dual highway, but 57 went in and obsoleted that idea. So there's a lot of room that you don't usually have on a roadside. So Stephanie Dobbs is in charge of roadside management throughout the state, and she communicates with township supervisors and the like, and just asking questions about this corridor and its possibilities is rather helpful if you can think to do that. It's possible that there will be funding for that sort of thing, and it will take you to places like Loder. The 10-mile Paxton won't take you the extra mileage to Loder, but it will give you an idea. You're getting near to three cemeteries that have not been worked over, so the prairie that's on them is native. And there are good sites of native prairie on that road that goes between Rantoul, Ludlow, and Paxton. Ludlow gives you an idea of elevating. It gives you an idea of a small town that was once the terminus of the Illinois Central Railroad. So, bully to the National Wildlife Fund for thinking about that. I had a call from, or an email from someone who wanted to perhaps buy the Pope Prairie, not knowing that it was a prairie, so I wrote a little diatribe about it, and he was interested in concrete, and concrete people need to store their equipment, and would this be a good place for equipment? My comment to him was helpful, and he's thinking that he could be a vital part of restoring the corridor if there were contract opportunities, because as a concrete company, the culverts between Rantoul and Paxton have been removed for liability reasons, and they would need to be reinstated. I think that my comments to him would be appropriate, because he responded to say that I'd mentioned Ken, his grandfather, and he said, yes, that's my grandfather, and Ken Mogul was the planner at Rantoul, and he knows well what we were trying to do with the corridor between Rantoul and Paxton. It goes further south to the Pumpkin Vine, where there's a 3 mile east-west rail trail. It's not as free-floating in terms of nature, but it's there. I have to add that Liz Kirby has been wanting to remind us that some of these places need to be treated in a term called wilding. There's a tendency to take your prairie and replace it, to dig it up and reconstitute it. Not always a good idea, because there's a lot of material there that has deep roots and adventitious buds, and it can come back. So wilding is an attempt to take sites that have 5 or 10 or 15 very recognizable prairie plants and add to it. You can dipsy doodle seed into it. You can plant plants into it. You can protect plants. You can put a fence around them so that deer doesn't get to them. Some perennial plants, I see some people using milk jugs to plant seed and to make a statement as to where the seed is, and cut the plastic milk jug in half and use the top half as a protective screen for perennial plants. I want to say something about fire and the results of fire. The Australians are having a hard time, and they've had a lot of fire, but they've now had a lot of rain. And when you have fire, it takes out a lot of the material roots and the vegetation that protects the ground. So you get landslides, and the movement of soil. And that soil sometimes can be if it's in farmland especially, it may have poison materials in it. It may have fertilizers and herbicides. And that goes into the river and down the Mississippi to, or in Australia, down the various rivers and into the ocean. The scar of a landslide also makes the vegetation go back to regrowth succession, and so you're going backwards. It might take 10,000 years to recreate the native vegetation that was there. Yeah. One of the real problems is that the forest fires that have been occurring, taking out not only the old growth, and the old growth varies. There's a rough, tough eucalyptus forest on limestone or shale or sandstone soils that are sedimentary soils that are fairly leached. But where there's a little bit of volcanic action and some fertile material, instead of having dry sclerophyll forests, you have wet sclerophyll forests, and they're very tall. And when they burn, they sometimes are burned so seriously that they don't survive. Although most eucalypts have adventitious buds that will return, but it takes a long time for these things to grow. One of the problems is the fire frequency is about once every 4 years. By that time, your trees have begun to grow as shrubs and regrowth succession. You'll have a lot of what the Australians call wattle, which is an acacia. And so you'll get back 4 years of action, and then the fire comes again, and it not only takes out the dead wet sclerophyll forest, but also the understory regrowth, and that's a problem. So how do you solve that? It's rather expensive. You're in terrains that are not easy to negotiate. You're working with helicopters you have to first of all observe when various trees are flowering, and if you don't want to lose the more endangered species, you have to annotate that pretty carefully. Then you, when you come back, you come back when the seed is on, and the seed is very fine. It's almost amazing that big trees can grow out of such a seed. That you cut off some, but not all, of the trees to create a genetic gene pool of seed. That's very fine. A pound of seed would go a long way. And then if a fire comes through, you know where your mountain ash was or other plants, and you can reconstruct that forest and hope that it grows relatively fast, and also that you don't create an endangerment where the species will be lost altogether. It's rather a serious business in Australia. It's got a very unique flora and fauna, ranging from kangaroos to koala bears to wallabies to creatures like birds, the lyrebirds, that are tremendously clever at mimicking things. So they can mimic the squeakiness of a oxen-drawn wagon, or they can simulate a chainsaw, or a tremendously expert doing that. But if the fire goes through, they don't have much chance of surviving. So Australia has lost a lot of its unique vegetation and wildlife at the moment. So retaining the habitat, recreating the habitat, is important. One bird that I appreciated a lot was a bellbird, and that's really wonderful musical expression of it lives in a sort of damp corner, and you know that the bellbirds are just there, and if that habitat goes, then so do the bellbirds. So the Australians are having floods now, because fortunately rain has come and exterminated quite a few of the fires that were so extensive. The flooding will be fairly extreme. I grew up with it. Means that you cut off communication with your local communities. Bridges, if you don't have a lot of finance, you put bridges very low, because if a flood comes and it is rather high and it has trees and rock and rubble in the water, it's going to be very brown, and it's going to go out into the Pacific. So you put your bridge very low. That means that you don't have communication in a high flood. If you have finance enough, you can put the bridge high. In the little town that I grew up in, the low bridge has eventually been replaced by a high bridge, so you can communicate between Bellinger and Dorigo, which is about 20 miles, and it's going from coastal plain to an escarpment that's 2,000 feet high. And on that mountain, you do have a mixture of sedimentary rocks and the occasional igneous rock from volcanic activity. And so on the sedimentary rocks especially, you would expect to have landslides. So there was a detail, a governmental person that lived in our little village, and his sole responsibility, Mr. McLeod, used to have to go up and remove the stone that had come by landslide. So often that 7 miles of sharp bends and curves would be closed off until people could get the road open again. And there's always the risk that as you were moving up that corridor, you could have landslides happen. And that can happen. Having grown up with this situation, I can understand how difficult it is to recreate the rainforest, which is mostly associated with volcanic outliers, and the sedimentary forests, and the little places that are often on the alluvial floodplains, which are receiving a little bit of nutriment from the volcanic areas enough to allow the tall, wet sclerophyll forest to grow. And it not only grows itself, but it grows a whole bunch of cockatoos. If you go visit it, there's such a cacophony that you can hardly talk to each other. And these birds are talking to each other and in a very noisy manner. They're white crested cockatoos, which are very large, and they're modest cockatoos that are very gay in their colors, and they're part of this landscape, and it's so disappointing to see them disappear. In Western Australia, which has remarkable wildflowers, they're now having fires there too. So part of this is you have to imagine it, that behind all of this there may be a wobble in the world that has led in the past to exterminations. So we have to wonder how long we'll be around. Some of the concern has been that there are countless human beings that require food, and there's a human element to exacerbate the what might be natural movement of the planet. So we need to think about that and see what can be done. I recently went to a food situation in the co-op, and it was by someone who was using seed that was much more able to survive in drought and wet, and he was comparing it with corn, and corn is ubiquitous. I'm not sure that we need to only live on corn and wheat and barley and oats and those crops that yield very well and have been trained to yield well. But this is a crop that is very low, knee high at the most. It's hard to harvest. It's but it's extremely nutritious, and so some of the countries that have been colonialized and converted to corn and wheat and one crop agriculture have had people who are encouraging some of these plants that were used by native tribes before there was a colonial takeover. We need more of that. We need to have gene pools. We need botanical gardens where some of these creatures get to grow. We need seed banks that need to be grown and regrown and regrown so that we don't lose the seed viability. And the University of Illinois has a gene pool of soybeans. Glycine plants around the world were collected, and so, but you have to imagine that that has to be for a number of different species that are not only nutritious, but they are survivors. That also has something to do with the sociology. There's a tendency with colonialism to look for income. And when they see a lot of little villages that are doing things with small plants and nutrition that's different, to combine this and do a multi-acreage of corn or some crop that's a monocrop, then you lose not only the crop that is unique that the villagers are using, but you ruin the rural sociology. So some of that is coming back. It also has something to do with population. You know, we don't say a lot about population. Everyone has the right to have a family. But many of these cultures had their own way of making sure that they didn't have an overpopulation. So they were sustainable. And the Indian tribes that we have knew that sort of thing. The Aboriginal tribes in Australia knew that sort of thing. They didn't have excess number of children. And so a world that is overcrowded with humans is a challenge. That would suggest that we think in terms of fewer children per family. That means that your gross national product is going to go down rather than up. So it's a very great challenge for people who are trying to survive the ecology of a world. So we encourage roadsides. I've had several things to do this week with roadsides. And I spoke a little bit of them just a little while ago, but roadsides have tremendous potential. But they also have a lot of challenge because people have gotten used to mowing. And so neat and tidy often means you strip the landscape of its vegetation, and often that vegetation has been regarded as weeds because you want to produce cattle and crops. If you're in the Amazon, then Brazil is at the moment encouraging the rainforest to be removed at a rapid rate. And that rainforest has a lot to do with how it controls the world's climate, not only in Brazil, but around the world. And we have to think about that. And the difference is that we have to, if you're an Australian and you have lots of coal and you can sell to China, then that's the... It's encouraging you to retain your mines and perhaps even sell that coal to other communities that need the energy. So there's this tug between the economics and the common sense. And it ain't an easy territory to be involved with. So I talked to Kim Campbell. We've had Kim Campbell on. We've had quite a few people that I'm talking today about. Brian Adams, we had him here talking about Royal Buildings. And so we've had Kim Campbell on. He's a beekeeper that is at a farmer's market with a yellow truck, and he sells honey. And one of the questions we have is, how do you produce that honey? I grew up with a next-door neighbor who was a beekeeper, and he got his primary bee colonies climbing up trees and salvaging colonies. And he started his whole apiary that way. He would take the apiary to seaside areas where in wintertime that was a good source of nutriment for the bees. There were little flannel flowers and those unique Australian plants. It was like the sand dunes and areas where these plants could grow and even reproduce and flower. And then when it came to be spring and the trees I was talking about, the wet sclerophyll trees, the beekeeper, Betteridge is his name, would take a pickup truck and a rifle, and he would check out the capacity of those trees to produce by shooting down a small limb of trees so that he could check the nectar. And if things were right, and I've been involved with helping him do this, he would take several trucks to the beach areas where he had overwintered his bees, and we'd load up the trucks and go to where the nectar was next. You waited till dark and the bees came into their hives. Some of them with several supers on them that made them very heavy. And you'd put a little cleat across the doorway, and we'd put a cup of water in there. Bees are sensitive, and we would keep the trucks a little distance from the hives because they were very allergic to fumes. And you could tell because you would get stung by bees a lot. So a little bit of water calms things down a little bit, and you'd load those hives onto trucks and take them to, in our case, a mountain area where the trees were doing well. The other creatures were doing well too. Fred was quite able to find the snakes, and he would annoy snakes and play with them, which I wasn't awfully excited about. But he was very used to native vegetation and the whole ecology. We would wait till the bees had operated on this. You'd have to check them out every so often to see if the supers were full of honey. These are not necessarily native Australian bees. They're Italian bees, and they're convenient because they make a hexagon type framework, so you create a hive that has a lot of opportunity for the formation of wax. You can start off by giving a wax basis for the bees to operate on, and when a a super. That's a box of these sleeves. It's to be ready for harvest. You have a steam outlet so that you have a centrifuge, and you take a knife that is hot, and you decapitate the top of these storage units, and then you put the frame into the centrifuge, and you centrifuge the honey. That is a very convenient, and if you're lucky, you can move into the forest and find a place to park and do that operation. It's a lot of hard work. I think at the moment it's costing about a dollar a pound to produce honey in that manner. You have to have trucks, you have to have equipment. We didn't necessarily use a lot of protective clothing, but that can be an expense. We would use a hats. But you got used to being stung every once in a while, and you got to be very careful. You didn't whack on a bee and produce a lot of biochemicals that other bees would get upset about, and then you'd have a storm. So if you had a bee in your hair, you took your hand very carefully and encouraged that bee out of the hair. You didn't whack it. And you had to be aware that certain parts of your body were very vulnerable. One of the most difficult parts is the bridge of your nose, the where nothing can expand. So when you're bitten by a bee, stung by a bee, it's not a bite, it's an injection more or less, there's no way of expanding. So that can be tremendously painful. If you have a shin on your leg, which has not a lot of room for expansion, the same sort of thing can be there. But you just treat these creatures as for real, and they were friends, and you just didn't violate their dignity. And many people that are looking at these bees because they're the harvest and the honey has in it biochemicals that are good for health, and so this can be an industry. It can also be a private system. You got to be careful because you can buy in bees and they are not as viable as some, so you have to select your purchase and make sure that you have good bees to start with. There are other bees, and these are bees we've had on, Michelle Duane, who is a specialist in bumblebees. Bumblebees are much bigger than an Italian bee. They have huge shoulders. They can go into a fluted flower and rumble with their shoulders and get covered in pollen and pollinate. So they're extremely important. But they're also very vulnerable. They're not going to be convenient in providing you with an easy way of harvesting honey. They live often in the ground, in litter, and they are modestly communal, but not nearly as communal as the Italian bee. And they are important, but they're dying out at a rapid rate. And that's kind of a sad situation. The Italian bees do also pollinate, as well as the native species. But these days, if you want to grow almonds or certain crops, very, very dependent on being pollinated. And so it's not unusual these days to encounter a truckload of bees, even a semi-trailer load of bees, that can be taken to an orchard so that they can pollinate. As you think about what you eat and where it comes from, then think about the creatures that are involved in the background. You have to make sure that over winter your hives have enough to eat. If they're not harvesting from flowers, then you need to give them a certain amount of sugary material to work on. You have to make sure that they don't overproduce, and then the hive will discombobulate and go to seek a new location and leave some of the old, but have new. And so that's how Fred Betteridge got his apiary in the first place, was to find bees that had moved on. And we have that locally. People will find a beehive underneath their front stoop or in an attic, and it's in a place where they walk by and they get stung. And so often bees don't survive because of that. We have to think about calling up an apiarist and getting them to salvage. I'm looking at my notes. David had suggested that this we do something about bees, so he might have some comment as to why he had made. He's been doing Master Garden, Master Naturalist,
if you please.
So, was there a reason why you were interested in bees?
Yes, and it wasn't bees in particular. It was more about what can people put in their yards to provide for pollinators in general. So besides the bees, you'd have butterflies are probably the best two known groups, but also there are lots of other pollinating insects besides those. So I forget the name of the website. You can subscribe to it, and people will post information if they've got things they don't need here. Someone can come and take this. If there was a break in somebody's house, you don't let people know that there are people out there who are, you know, burglarizing and things like that. And this last week, somebody asked, what can I do to bring more pollinators to my yard? Specifically, I have a very shady yard. And several people chimed in and said, okay, well, that rules out most milkweeds, but there's poke milkweed, I guess, grows in shady areas. So what I suggested to you is, if you wanted to, you could take 5 minutes or whatever to tell us, what are some things that people can do in their own yards, considering you don't have that much space? And in particular, since we've got coming up in May, the sale of prairie plants over at Lincoln Square, what are things that are perfectly good for people to go out and just get wildflower seeds? What are things that people would be better off going to this sale in May and getting plants that have already been started? What's the difference between those two?
Yes, that's very good. So, thanks. One of the things we need to know is we're interested in prairie. And some of the food that provides for wildlife is cultivated. And so there's a difference between having a prairie plot in your backyard and having a pollinator plot. And so Chicago is very pleased with itself because it has hundreds of these pollinator plots dotted around the city, and it's very effective. So let's not discount the pollinator plots. You could also have pollinators on roadsides. Some of you will travel in summer, and you will see bands of yellow, and these are yellow and white. They're sweet clover, two types of sweet clover, and they're wonderful pollinators. So pollinator people will encourage that sort of planting of the roadside. If we're trying to maintain that roadside as a prairie, we will be very disturbed by having that sort of aggressive plant. And the same goes for your backyard. If you want to put in a cultivator plot with native plants as well as cultivated plants, that's fine. You will actually be able to go to the city and get a variance so that you don't have to mow that front yard. Yeah. That causes problems sometimes because some people just let their front yard grow, and that doesn't, that's not a pollinator plot. And if that gets to be a weed plot, the city can arrive with a sign to say that if you don't mow your front lawn, you will have it mown for you, and you'll be taken to court and fined for not mowing your front lawn. So if you're going to do a pollinator plot, then make sure that it is a pollinator plot and not just letting your weeds grow and saving you the bother of mowing.
So can you recommend places for people to get either the plants themselves or, you know, good sources to get? What should people look for a good source of, for example, seed in particular?
Seed is not so good because it takes most prairie plants are perennials. The grasses will grow well, but the grasses aren't pollinators. They're pollinated by wind. They have huge pollen sacs, and the wind blows the pollen around. So you avoid, if you're into pollinators, you avoid the grasses. And that takes out a little of the character of the prairie, but it's helpful for your pollinators. Seed is possible. I mentioned just a moment ago taking your milk jug and cutting it in two and putting some soil in the milk jug and putting in pollinator seed. And that gives you an idea of where the seed is, and it gives a home for the seed to grow. And if it's a perennial, it probably doesn't need a lot of water. You leave the top off the milk jug, and you close it up and come back a month or so later, and your perennial plant may be growing. But if you're just sowing seed in the corner, you won't know where it is unless you label it. And so it needs a little tender, loving care. And it's sometimes better to buy from the Grand Prairie Friends at their May sale a plant that has grown sometimes in a greenhouse, but it's got roots and it's ready to go. And it will cost you a little more, but it's much more instant gratification if you're wanting to have a plot that grows quickly. Some of the seed takes 10 years to grow. If you are growing culver's root, then it will grow, but you won't recognize the character of this growing. And all of a sudden, after 5 years, you'll walk around and there is culver's root, and there it is with its inflorescence, and it's really very elegant, and it's attracting insects, but it takes that long for it to grow. If we're dealing with a wilding situation, if you already have some native plants and cultivars, you can dipsy-doodle seed into it, if you don't mind not remembering where you put the seed. But there's a good reason for knowing a little bit about what you're doing. If you have a plant like ironweed, which likes to be damp, then you might want to have a place where it's damp. If you're thinking that you can make it damp by changing the landscape a bit, if you have enough room, you can put a bulldozer in and change the landscape. That doesn't always work, because that landscape that encourages the ironweed has been growing for years, and it has a bacteria and fungi in the soil, and when you remodel it with a shovel or a bulldozer, you take away that environment. So it's not always easy to sculpt the landscape and then expect it to take over your plant immediately. Some plants are quite dependent on other plants or the bacteria and fungi in the soil. So you will get to know some plants that like to be dry and high. Mm-hmm. We have some of this debate with the like of the Kickapoo Trail, because it is cheaper to look at a mile of railroad bed and sculpt it, carve it off, and then come back with planting of prairie. But it would be much more costly, but much more appropriate to, if you have a cross-section and you only have to cut off 4 inches to do that with a high hoe from a side and not destroy the native terrain that you're trying to plant into. You can dipsy-doodle into that, but you need to try and save the native nature of your territory. One of the problems that most houses have is that contractors don't like to build houses, especially basements, on topsoil. So they take the topsoil off and build a basement and build a house, and the material that's on the outside of the house is basically clay. Quickly. Then if you put rain onto that, it runs off. So the tendency is to put in 4 inches of topsoil on the top to give you a good lawn. But that sort of situation, you have to know a little about in order to have a sense of humor about how your native vegetation and soil is. This is Dave Monk, your Prairie Monk, WEFT Champaign, 90.1 on your FM dial.
And Dave on the board. As always, the views and opinions expressed here are solely those of the speakers and no one else. It is moments before noon here at WEFT. That means it's time now for Shruti, Music of India.